This time of year, when we're trying to keep warm and dreaming of spring, is a great time to think about learning new skills that will help you and your garden grow. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. This hour, we're going to talk about some educational opportunities for gardeners and landowners. Andy Larson is a specialist in small farm sustainability with Iowa State University Extension. We'll talk about the Homegrown Lifestyle course for 2014, where participants can learn about growing food, caring for small-scale livestock, and even keeping bees. And horticulturist Richard Giron will be here to talk about some other educational opportunities. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and this hour we're going to talk about some educational opportunities for gardeners and landowners. And, of course, later in the hour we will be answering your questions. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here today. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And Andy Larson is here. He's a specialist in small farm sustainability with Iowa State University Extension. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
And you are back again to talk about the Homegrown Lifestyle course. What is this?
It's a 12-week extension program that we put on that's specifically designed for small acreage owners, farmettes, folks who are trying to reconnect with the land and grow some of their own food and some of their own livestock for personal and family use. It's really a get your feet wet in local food productions course. We cover everything from soup to nuts, quite literally. So it's trying to give folks a really holistic introduction to some of the things that they could do on their small acreage and give them the tools to get started in it pretty darn quick.
Now, how long have you been doing this program?
This is the fourth season, the fourth spring that we've put it on.
Has demand been growing for this over the years?
Oh, it's stayed pretty consistent. We've had around 100 folks in it every year.
And where is it offered throughout the state?
Well, this year we're going to have six different counties participating in it through their extension offices. Story and Boone counties here in central Iowa, Jefferson County, that's the Fairfield area, Warren County, we're going to do it at the Farm Bureau building in Indianola, Muscatine down in southeastern Iowa, the Muscatine County Extension Office, and in Sioux City in the Woodbury County Extension Office.
All right, and you mentioned it's 12 weeks long. What kind of a commitment are people making when they sign up?
Basically, it's 12 Thursday nights from 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. The three-hour session includes a webinar from a state expert on the topic of the day, and then a hands-on component in the second half of the evening where they're building a rain barrel, or they're learning how to put together a worm composter, or they're making goat's milk soap. They're trying to figure out some way to apply the skills that they and the information that they've just learned from the presenter.
All
so
right.
They have those 12 weeks, and then there'll be a tour, sort of a capstone kind of activity at the end to see somebody's property where they've put these kind of strategies in place.
A field trip.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Well, and you mentioned the variety of things that you'll be talking about during the program. I'm looking at the different subjects, and one of the first that you're working on, and you'll be one of the instructors, is Farmscape and Edible Landscape Design. Can you take us a little bit more in depth and tell us about that?
Sure. I've spent a little bit of time reading and studying about permaculture, and it's essentially just thinking about your layout of your land and thinking about the way that things flow through it, be it wind or sun or water or livestock or anything else, and trying to design your production system around those patterns so you're working in concert with the natural flows rather than always trying to fight against what it is nature wants to do on your property. So putting a rain garden in a place where water tends to accumulate, putting deciduous trees on the side of the house where the sun is, so it's got sun exposure in the winter and sun protection in the summer. So it's just some of those concepts to make your production system a little bit less energy intensive and a little bit less argumentative with Mother Nature.
Well, and that's really the focus of the first 2 weeks, because then the next week you're talking about soil and water resources. So it's really a foundation in taking a look at the land and learning how to work with it.
That's exactly right. Soil is so important, whether you're raising plants or animals. The health of your soil and the soil microbiology is so fundamental to the health of the rest of your production system that we're going to have a soil health specialist from our Natural Resources Conservation Service here in Iowa, Rick Benark. He's going to be coming in to talk about soil health specifically and how you can maintain it on a small acreage.
All right. So you'll talk about vegetables and growing fruits.
Yep.
One of the subjects that kind of caught my attention is trees and wild crops. What kinds of things fall? I mean, obviously, I understand trees as a category. But
sure.
What kind of things fall into the wild crops category?
Well, people look for mushrooms and ramps. People look for ginseng. Some people actually cultivate ginseng in forest lands in the state of Iowa. But we're also considering the fruits and berries and nuts that can be produced on a situation where trees are put in for a windbreak or for a regular timber ground. It's kind of for those folks who want to do some of that wild harvesting. They want to use what's out there as sustenance for themselves and their family. And that's what they're going to get sort of a small introduction into, as well as how to use trees strategically to protect your production system, your house, and your landscape.
And you also have food storage and preservation. Is that a canning workshop?
Canning, freezing, drying, dehydrating. It's going to be a quick introduction with Mary Crisco to all of those different topics. They do another extension course called Preserve the Taste of Summer, and this is sort of a teaser trailer for that course, because you'll see some of the different methodologies you can use, how to can safely, how not to burn yourself, how not to get food poisoning from the things that you're doing with your own personal
things.
Harvest. Yeah.
All right. So also composting and manure. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, I think it's fun. And the woman who's doing the presentation, Angie Rickens, she thinks it's fun as well. It's one of those things that a lot of people who want to get into livestock on a small scale don't really spend enough time thinking about, because manure is really a resource. It's not just one of those things that you have to try and get rid of. If you collect, compost, store, and apply correctly, it can be an incredible way to increase the productivity and the fertility of your production system.
And if you're new to livestock, chances are you'll have a lot more of it than you ever imagined you would have.
Oh,
probably,
yeah.
True.
Absolutely. And she'll actually give you an equation for how to calculate the volume that you're going to be dealing with from any particular animal. It's kind
nice.
Of hilarious.
So I mean, you do talk about livestock, grazing and ruminants. So I assume that you're talking mostly about goats and cows?
Mostly about sheep and goats.
Oh, sheep.
Usually folks who have a small number of acres can't sustain a lot of cattle, maybe one or two. Really, Dan Moracle is our extension small ruminant specialist, and he's been keeping sheep for a long time, and he has a lot of knowledge about goats, and he'll talk about how to keep them healthy, how to keep them in. That's always one of the big questions with sheep and goats, is what kind of a fence you got to have.
Right, and definitely keep them away from your car.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, you must have had one of those experiences with a goat on top of
yes.
your car, Charity.
I've been there.
Climbers, that's for sure.
Those little hooves are not good for the outside of your
car.
Yeah,
the body shop wonders what kind of hail damage you ended up with.
And then you're teaching about backyard poultry.
Well, I've been sort of a hobby chicken keeper for a number of years, and starting next week, my wife and I are going to be the proud owners of about 300 laying hens. So,
wow. That doesn't sound like a hobby anymore.
No, it's moving past the hobby scale for sure. So, yeah, I'll be myself and Ron Keene from University of Wisconsin have always hit that topic. And it's a lot of interest in backyard poultry, and there's a lot of misinformation out there around backyard poultry. I even have a set of 7 YouTube videos on the Iowa State Extension channel about how to keep backyard poultry, how to keep them in and safe and fed and unfrozen during the winter.
Yeah, that has been a challenge this winter for a lot of people, I'm sure.
Oh, you betcha.
Now, the group that you were talking about, people who own land who might be interested in growing food on that land, that seems like a really wide range. What is the kind of variety among the people who sign up for this?
Oh, the variety is one of the best things about it, because we get urban homeowners that have 1 acre and a big garden and are trying to figure out how to produce a greater proportion of what they eat off of that acre, right on up to, you know, conventional farmers in the state of Iowa who are trying to they're trying to add an enterprise to their farmstead, usually, just for personal use. How to have sheep or goats, how to garden on a larger scale, how to do composting. This isn't designed for folks who are looking for a business planning course. It's more designed for folks who are looking to get ideas for how to implement something new and interesting that's going to produce food on their place. And the variety is great. We've had wonderful experience from, for example, experienced grazers coming into a homegrown lifestyle class and teaching other people about keeping sheep and goats and how to keep your pastures healthy and things like that. So the variety is one of the strong points.
All right, so registration is open now.
Yes.
And classes start when?
They're going to start on March the 20th, Thursday, March 20th, and go for 12 Thursdays after that. And registration is open on homegrownlifestyle.org.
All right. And Richard, there are some other opportunities as well. And of course, Andy's going to stay with us. He will answer questions if you have questions for him throughout the hour. And Richard, there are some other educational opportunities this time of year as well. What's coming up?
Yes, there are. The Linn County Master Gardeners are going to have a winter gardening fair. And that's going to be Saturday, February 15th at Kirkwood Community College.
All right. And that has a whole variety of topics that you can sign up to go. And, of course, you can't do everything, but there are a lot of choices.
But it's a full day. The cost is $49 per person. And they have various speakers, Jim Pease, Patrick O'Malley, Denny Schrock, Gary Wittenbaugh. So many, many speakers on various topics.
So a lot of the people that you hear on Horticulture Day or on Talk of Iowa will be there. Any other educational opportunities coming up this spring?
Well, if you have a desire to maybe do some grafting as far as fruit trees, there will be a grafting workshop in Iowa City on Saturday, March 29th. Contact Patrick O'Malley on that. But if you have, for example, let's say a old declining apple tree, you want to propagate it, you can go to this session and maybe learn how to propagate that tree.
Oh, terrific. And of course, there are a lot of Iowa State University Extension publications online as well if you're looking for some education at home. We'll be back in just a moment to take your calls, your questions about the things that you're trying to grow or grow better in your life. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here today. Andy Larson is a specialist in small farm sustainability with Iowa State University Extension. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Andy Larson. He's a specialist in small farm sustainability with ISU Extension. They're here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you're planning your garden for spring and you have questions, or landscaping questions, house plants that are ailing, want to talk more about educational opportunities, give us a call, 866-780-9100. And Daryl is up first in Cedar Falls. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, I have two questions. One is I have two crown of thorns that are about 20, 25 years old, and they're due for repotting this spring. They are about 3 feet across each of them. They sprawl all over the place and take up the whole south window. And I'm wondering whether I should prune them before, at the same time as, or after I have repotted them.
Okay. I think I would do that at the same time. So I would probably go ahead and prune them and then immediately repot them.
Okay. Okay, because, I didn't know if that would shock them or what. Okay, the other question is also kind of prickly. I have a blackberry bush out in the backyard that got out of control last summer, and I need to get that back under control. Can I do that as soon as spring comes?
Now, these are blackberries, not raspberries, but blackberries.
Blackberries.
Okay. When you say they're getting out of control, they're getting too widespread, or?
Yes. They are tangled and widespread, and they just need to be thinned. And it's only one bush, but it's about 5 feet tall and 4 feet across or 5 feet across, and it keeps catching me as I move around it.
Okay, yeah. So what I would do is I would go out there probably in early April, and I would cut out any dead wood that you find in the plant. And the dead wood should kind of be brown in color, so it should be pretty easy to identify. And then I would probably dig up portions of the plant that are beyond this, let's say, 2 foot wide row. I don't really want anything wider than 2 foot. And so if you have some canes coming up beyond this 2 foot wide area, what I would do is I would cut them back to near ground level, then dig them up, and if you want more plants, simply plant them in a row or give them to a neighbor or friend.
Okay.
And they can plant them.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, Daryl, thanks a lot for your call, and we have room for your call next at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. And Daryl's question about his blackberry bush made me think more about the edible landscape design that you'll be talking about in the Homegrown Lifestyle course, Andy. And, you know, I've noticed, and Richard, you can weigh in on this too, because I'm sure you've noticed as well, that on this show over the past year or 2 years, we've gotten a lot more questions about growing nuts. Is growing nuts in Iowa something that seems to be a growing trend?
Well, I think there is actually a group. It's the Iowa Nut Growers Association, and for some, it's a very, very important hobby. We can grow certain nuts, definitely. For example, the black walnuts and the hickories, and in southeast Iowa, the pecans. So we do have a number of nuts that we can grow. They're native to the state. They're not hard to grow, so...
And I know a couple of folks who have started to grow hybrid hazelnuts as sort of a big hobby or a side income type of opportunity as well.
And the pecan is actually native to the state?
Far southeast Iowa, yes it is.
Wow, that's interesting.
Now, when you get to central Iowa, hardiness becomes an issue. And oftentimes, if the trees do survive, they don't produce much in the way of nuts. But in far southeast Iowa, yes, it's native.
Interesting. And have we noticed, I know that the zones have been shifting just a little bit over the years.
A little bit.
Are we able to grow nuts a little bit further north than we were?
Well, a little bit, but not a great deal. We can grow, for example, pecans in central Iowa, but oftentimes they're just not going to produce much. That's their very far northern edge. And while they'll survive, they just don't do much as far as producing.
Well,
so.
And a winter like this is
yes.
a good reminder.
Yes, this is Iowa.
It's still cold here in the wintertime. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dale is on the line in Linn County. Hi, Dale.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Good. I love your show. Hey, I wanted to kind of hop back on that blueberry thing for a moment. I got a little bigger problem than the previous caller. My patch is probably, I'm going to say 25 or 30 feet wide, and it could be 100 feet long. It was planted, I think we're getting into the third or fourth year now, and I've never really understood how to handle this pruning. And I don't know, I almost think I'd be risking life and limb to try and get in there and do any...
Are you talking about blueberries or blackberries?
No, this is blackberries.
Okay,
this
blackberries.
Blackberries.
This is those thornless blackberries that produce the great big blackberries. And what I was wondering was, what would you think of the idea of getting in there and mowing right down the center with a 6 foot wide brush hog mower, and then let that center patch come back over the next year or two, and then do my selective pruning on those outer edges, you know, that would be more in line with the width that these blackberry patches probably ought to be.
How wide is the patch right now, would you say?
I'd say it's 25 or 30 feet wide. I think I could take a 6-foot swath out of the middle without any problem.
Okay. What I'd probably do is I'd go out there with my tape, and I would mark off certain areas, and I would basically retain like a 2-foot wide strip.
Okay.
And then I would cut everything down to the ground in the next 5 to 6 feet. Everything right down to the ground I would cut.
Okay.
And then I would till it up and destroy those plants.
Oh.
And then leave another 2 feet of plants, and then destroy another 5 to 6 feet of plants.
Okay.
So you're basically done. When you're done, you're left with rows about 2 feet wide with a 5-foot area between, kind of a walkway. Because
right.
when they're a solid patch, you can't get in there to pull weeds or to prune them or to harvest them. It's just a thicket. And it's just not manageable. So you want to keep these in a 2-foot wide row basically, and then have like a 5 to 6 foot walkway in between. So I would just go out there and mark it off and then destroy certain plants and start over.
And will tilling it up, will that destroy the plants?
You'll probably have to till them and then kind of pull them out too, because if you leave them in the ground, if you just simply till, you still have those roots in the ground, and they'll probably resprout. So you want to till them so you can actually remove them, basically.
Okay. Okay, Roundup doesn't have any place in this program you're talking about.
Well, in this situation, not really, because these are basically coming up from roots. They're all kind
right.
of, they're kind of interconnected. And
yeah.
so if you apply a Roundup to, let's say, a certain plant, it may spread to some of the adjacent plants because they're connected. So
right.
not
okay.
the best way to use it in this situation, no.
Okay. Okay. Well, I sure appreciate it.
All right,
Thank
Dale.
You.
Thanks a lot for your
yep.
call.
You
Next
bet.
Up at 866-780-9100 is Robert in Marshalltown. We're talking berries some more. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, similar problem. I'd like to get rid of and reclaim a raspberry patch.
Okay. And these are these red raspberries or?
Yes, everbearing.
Okay. And what is the current situation?
Well, I'm just not utilizing them anymore, and I'd like to reclaim it, plant a regular type garden.
Okay.
And the patch has started with 4 canes, of course, and now it's a 5-foot by 20-foot patch.
Okay. I would probably just cut them back to the ground this spring and then basically till them up and
okay.
Remove as much of the plant material as you can, physically remove it. You might have to wait until maybe next year to plant just to make sure
okay.
everything is gone as far as the raspberries, but that's what I would do. I would just cut them back to the ground, get a heavy-duty tiller, till it up, physically remove what you can as far as the plant parts, and
okay.
wait. And when you get new sprouts coming up, dig those up and destroy those. And I would think by maybe early to mid-summer, basically it should be under control.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Robert.
Thanks, Charity. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next up, Mona is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Mona.
Hi. Good morning. My name is Mona Scaldi from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. How are you doing?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
I would like to ask what kind of fruit trees I can have in my backyard. I have a pretty big backyard. Also, if I can plant persimmon in my backyard.
As far as fruit trees, I guess I would start probably with sour cherries or tart cherries. They're very nice, attractive trees. They're very productive. They don't require a lot of spraying, so I'd probably start with those. The sour cherries or tart cherries. Possibly pears. Okay. Now, with pears, you typically need 2 different varieties. In the area, so 2 different trees. With a sour cherry, you only need 1. But pears, possibly, possibly some plums. Okay. As far as apples definitely we can grow those, but they tend to be much more high maintenance in that if you don't spray them on a regular basis, oftentimes the insect damage tends to be fairly severe, and that can be a problem. But perfectly hardy in Iowa, we can grow them just fine. So the big issue with apples is basically spraying them.
And if you're into sauces, juices, or ciders, it doesn't have to be a cosmetically perfect apple.
Right.
You just don't want to expect exactly what you'd see in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm. How about persimmons?
Cedar Rapids?
Yeah.
That would be a possibility, I think, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Mona. Thanks a lot for your call. And Richard, last time we were on the air together, we talked a lot about ordering seeds. Is this also the time of year when if you wanted to plant a lot of fruit trees or a lot of trees, period, that you would need to be thinking about ordering seedlings?
Well, as far as if I were going to plant fruit trees, I would buy those locally at a garden center. And I would do that because they're going to be bigger trees at the local nursery. And when I go local, I can actually go there, inspect the trees, make sure they're nice, healthy, well-branched trees, and then select the best one. If I buy them through the mail, they're going to be smaller trees, and I get them sight unseen. So I would prefer to buy them locally and actually select them myself.
Now, we have had calls on the show in recent weeks, people wondering about specific apple varieties that may be harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
If you were looking for something like that, I know there are nurseries who sell online those varieties. Would you recommend going through your local nursery to order them or ordering direct with something like that?
Right. If you're looking for something unusual, and there are a number of heirloom varieties, for example, there are hundreds of varieties. And the local garden center is only going to stock maybe a dozen varieties, the common ones.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want something uncommon or heirloom, then there are a number of mail order sources. They have a wide selection, like Miller Nurseries in New York State, Rain Tree Nursery in Washington State. So the number of sites where they have these. I would go there just because they have things that you can't find locally.
Okay. Let's get back to the phones. And next up, Marilyn is on the line in Marshalltown. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I have a Meyer lemon tree that is potted, and it's about 3 feet tall in the pot. It's in my sunroom. It is blooming like crazy right now. And I have two questions. One, the first one's really about pollination. Do I need to do anything regarding pollination? The second question is that I have two, what I would call on my apple tree, suckers that are growing from the base of the tree. There's certainly room in the pot for these very vigorous young branches to be. Those two branches don't have any blossoms on them. Is it okay to leave them? Should I trim them while the tree's blooming, or what should I do with those?
Well, the new growth will not bloom. Basically, it has to grow and mature. It has to have a certain age before it can actually bloom. If you think the tree is well-shaped the way it is, I would remove them if they're unnecessary. If you have a nice, well-shaped plant, I would be inclined to simply remove those suckers.
Okay.
As far as pollination, nothing really there. You could just maybe kind of gently shake the plant a little bit to loosen the pollen and to encourage pollination.
Okay. So should I wait until it's done blooming to remove those suckers then? Is it okay to do it?
You can do that now, really. That's fine.
Okay.
Just print them off at the point of origin.
Awesome.
All right,
Thank
Marilyn.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Maxine in Des Moines. Hi, Maxine.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, we pulled up a lot of geraniums in the fall and dried them.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do about making them start growing again?
Well, basically when you do that, you want to store them in a cool, dry place where the temperature is around 40 to 45. And they should survive in that environment. much of the plant will actually die back, but not the entire plant. And so what I would do is just leave them there until probably around early March. Then in early March, I would take them down from that storage location, and I would cut them back. And basically what you're going to do is you're going to remove all the dead plant tissue. And the dead plant tissue will be shriveled and kind of brownish black. The live tissue will be green and solid, okay? And you simply prune it back to where you have live, solid green growth. Then you pot it up and put it in a sunny window. And within a few days, the plant will start to leaf out again.
All right, Maxine, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer more of your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talks and email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Andy Larson, who's a specialist in small farm sustainability with Iowa State University Extension. Again, you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Andy Larson, a specialist in small farm sustainability with ISU Extension. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Andy, here's an email for you from Andrea in Mount Vernon. We're thinking about experimenting with poultry this year. We have a small farm. We've done some research and found that there are some people who prefer ducks for egg production and some prefer chickens. Can you please explain the differences and the positive and negative aspects of both? maybe that's not your area. Right?
Well, the difference is I don't have a lot of experiences with duck production, but I'll tell you some secondhand information. One,
all right.
The duck eggs are kind of a big trend right now. So there is sort of a growing awareness about duck eggs and more demand amongst fancy restaurants and things like that. I don't know if there is a particularly large nutritional difference, but what I keep getting told is that duck eggs are richer than chicken eggs, whatever that means.
Okay.
Chickens and ducks, as far as maintenance, they're both pretty relaxed. I mean, you can get chores down to a small number of minutes per day with either one. People worry that for ducks, they have to have a big pond or some kind of body of open water for them to swim around in. And really, their water requirement is relatively small, but they do tend to make a little bit more mud than chickens do. Other than that, they can be just as good of home-scale domestic poultry as chickens can.
Are they as productive as far as laying goes?
You know, productivity really varies with the breed of animal. If you want to maximize productivity out of a bird, you're going to want to go with a commercial strain. So for chickens, it would be going through Highline or going through ISA and getting some of their genetics that are sure to produce, you know, one egg every 25 hours, like clockwork for 80 or 90 weeks. I don't know if there's that same kind of focus on, like a commercial focus on duck egg productivity. So I don't know how many eggs per week that you're going to, I don't know what the percentage is that you're going to tend to get out of a flock of ducks. But I would say that most homeowners tend to have more eggs than they can deal with themselves. So productivity isn't always a huge concern on the small scale.
Right, right. Well, it does sound like they are planning to sell if they're worried about what other people prefer as far as egg production. But
okay.
That's
well,
just
they've got
guess.
Restaurants in right. that area that would be interested, that's for sure.
All right. That's probably a first question for Horticulture Day on ducks and chickens. here's another question. This is from Adam. Can you talk about pruning currants? It seems very confusing. Can I do this yet before spring?
Well, I would basically do it probably in late March or early April before the actual shrub leaves out. And the key thing with currants and gooseberries is that the extremely old wood is not very productive. And so the main thing would be to go out and prune out really old wood completely. Most of the fruit are produced on shoots that are 2, 3, or 4 years old. And once they get beyond 4 years, our production goes down. So ideally what you want to do is go out there and remove basically all the old wood really back to the ground. So if you have like 5-year-old wood, 6-year-old wood, basically get rid of it. And that's going to encourage some new shoots to come up that growing season. And so the following year, you might do some removal of some of those new shoots that came up the previous year and also prune out the oldest shoots.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. 866-780-9100. Andy is on the road today. Hi, Andy.
Hey, good morning to you.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I was told recently that the grafted varieties of fruit trees do not need to be planted in pairs and able to cross-pollinate. And I wanted to know if that was true. And then also the question would relate to the new grafted tomatoes out there. Do you need to plant those in pairs and able to have cross-pollination?
As far as the apples, that is not true. Even though they're grafted, you still need 2 different apple varieties in the vicinity. As far as the tomatoes, they're self-fruitful. So you can have one plant and they'll produce. So the grafting has no effect.
Okay, well, I appreciate it.
All right, Andy, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Mark in Lamoni. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a European plum tree, and this year it has a lot of sap coming out of many areas of the tree, and I'm wondering what kind of a disease does it have, and what can I do to, is it worth saving? Can I save it?
Well, there are a number of reasons why you have these big blobs of sap form on the trunk or major branches. It could be insects, it could be disease, it could be weather-related. So there are a number of things that may be responsible for this. If you have large numbers of these big globs of sap on the trunk or branches, to me, that would indicate the tree is probably not going to be around for much longer. So I would kind of plan for the ultimate demise of that tree, and I might plant a new one this coming spring and hope the old tree will survive for maybe a few more years.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And next up is Chris in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Hi.
Just a quick question. Is it a good time to trim deciduous trees?
You can do it. But when it's really cold outside, I'd wait.
It seems like a really unpleasant time to trim deciduous trees.
But you can do it as far as the tree is concerned. I would simply wait until the weather's more favorable for you as far as going out and doing it. So I'd probably do it if it's not an oak. Let's say I have a maple or a linden or a crabapple. I'd be inclined to do it in March when the weather's nicer. But you can do it. But you can do it now.
Okay. Well, these are sycamore trees.
Okay.
And where they're at, I'm debating doing it now so they don't tear up the yard when it's soft in March or late March.
I see. So you're not actually planning on going out there yourself.
No. This is a professional job.
All right.
Yeah. No, you can do it right now. No problem at all.
Very good. That's all I need.
All right, Chris. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thanks.
That does change the equation, doesn't
it? Yes,
it
does. If somebody else is going to do it.
It doesn't sound that bad anymore, does it? All right. Jeffrey's on the line. Hi, Jeffrey.
Good morning. I have questions about worm compost. What type of worm do you use? And seeing the kind of weather we have today, can it exist outside, or would you have to have it in a garaged area or closed-in area?
Great questions. So the type of worm is commonly called a red wiggler worm. So it's not the night crawler that you'd go out and dig in your yard. It's a worm that is specifically adapted to eating organic materials and pooping out nice fertilizer. I can't think of the Latin name off the top of my head, but red wiggler worms That a search on the internet or a phone call, people will understand what you're talking about there. As far as keeping them outdoors, this time of year, it's not going to work out very well. Worms prefer a warmer environment than, well, most people prefer a warmer environment than what we got right now, but definitely need to be in the more temperate kind of zone. As a matter of fact, if your garage isn't well insulated and keeps out any kind of draft or wind or keeps the temperature above 50, I wouldn't even have them in the garage. The thing that's nice about worm composting, to do it on a small scale, you can do it in the kitchen or in the basement. It's not going to smell at all if you do it right. I've tried to worm compost before, and I found if I don't keep my compost bin somewhere where I'm seeing it on a regular basis and remembering to put my kitchen scraps in there on a regular basis, it doesn't get the food or the attention it needs. So my personal recommendation is to put that worm composter bin right where you're going to look at it, as long as the other people in the house are agreeable to that.
And what do you mean by small?
Well, you can do a worm composting setup in a Tupperware tub. That's just it's less than a cubic foot in size. It's probably half that. And you have your worms, you've got some sort of damp newspaper, some kitchen scraps, that kind of stuff to feed them. And when you want to get the worms out of the compost so you can remove the composted leavings for use for fertilizer, you just put new food over to one side. The worms will gravitate towards that new food, and you will have the empty earthworm castings that you can remove and apply to your plants.
I'll be done.
All right. Good luck with that, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Linda in Des Moines. Hi, Linda.
Oh, good morning. Love your show. I'm still laughing at the worm casting.
Yeah.
I have three sets of plants left over from when my mother died this fall. I have azaleas, mums, and Christmas cactus. The azaleas and the mums are now basically brown sticks with no leaves on them. The Christmas cactus still have some turgor. How do I know when these are done and dead, or should I hang on to them, and will they come back?
Well, the Christmas cactus you can definitely keep from year to year. It's a fairly low-maintenance plant. Just give it bright light, and I would say water it nicely every week or 10 days. Do that consistently. It's perfectly content.
Cool.
The azalea is totally brown as far as brown foliage?
No foliage. It's brown sticks.
Okay. I would take one of those sticks and bend it very sharply.
Okay.
If it's brittle and it snaps, the plant's dead.
Okay.
And I would toss it.
All right.
And the other plant is, again, what?
Mum.
A mum. No signs of life there?
A few stray leaves, but basically looks like the azalea.
Well, what I would do on that is just to make sure on that, I would cut it back to the ground, or maybe, let's say, an inch above the potting soil.
Okay.
And then water it nicely. Water it about once a week. And let's say in 3 or 4 weeks, if you see no signs of life, it's gone too.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, Linda, thank you so much for your call.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Next up, we have John on the line in Waterloo. Hi, John.
Hi. I saw somebody had a hemlock tree, or I guess Canadian or Eastern hemlock.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered how they do around here, and if they, how much, whether they need shade or and water, if they're, you know, if they're vulnerable to too much dryness or things like that.
Right.
And about weeping varieties, as far as, like weeping varieties or bushes as opposed to trees.
Right. Well, as far as the Canadian hemlock, we can grow it here in Iowa, but it's kind of demanding. Okay. For example, with a Canadian hemlock, you would not want to put this in an open, exposed area where it's very windy, very sunny, maybe kind of dry. You'd want to put it in a location maybe where it's a little bit cooler, a little bit more moist, okay? Here on campus at Iowa State, we typically have these trees on the east side of large buildings where they get plenty of sun during the day, but it's a little bit cooler, a little bit more moist. And so try to find a site where there is a little bit of protection, it's a little bit cooler, moist. And if you have a suitable location, they do fine. Now, some of the weeping types might be a little bit more finicky than the species. So I would look for a moist, well-drained soil, plenty of sun, preferably morning sun, not the hot afternoon sun, and see how they do.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, John. And we've got a couple of email questions to end the hour with. This is from Ken. I set up two large pots last spring. I used a combination of peat moss and bags of soil. One pot had a cherry tomato, and I planted leaf lettuce around the perimeter. The other with green pepper, and I planted spinach around the perimeter. They did fairly well, and I had some nice homegrown salads. I pulled and discarded the plants and brought the pots into the garage last fall. Can I add some peat moss or soil to replenish loss and replant this spring, or do I need to discard the medium and start over?
Well, I would say if they're extremely deep pots, I guess I might be inclined to maybe save the bottom few inches and put fresh on top of that. Because over time, old potting soil does kind of break down, and so the qualities are not as good as they were initially. So if it's a really deep pot, you probably don't need to fill it entirely with fresh. You might be able to save some of the old.
Well, and I know you're always reminding us to move our tomatoes every year. Does he need to try to switch pots? I'm assuming he probably wants another cherry tomato plant.
I wouldn't think so. When you grow tomatoes in the garden year after year, disease can build up eventually. But in a pot, just one year, I wouldn't think so. So if the plant appeared to be pretty healthy, I would say no problem putting tomatoes back in the same pot.
All right, and this is a final question from Nick in Chicago. He says, any special tricks to growing edamame, and can I grow it in a large planter?
Edamame is basically food-grade soybeans.
Right.
And special tricks? Not really. I mean, soybeans grow like crazy in Iowa. I imagine they'd grow pretty well in a planter. They don't need to have a lot of additional nitrogen fertility because they are nitrogen fixing. So they can produce their own nitrogen from the ambient air. So don't add a lot of extra fertilizer on that front. Also, don't let them grow too old because edamame are a bean that is eaten fresh and young and tender and green. So letting it go to the sort of pod fill stage that we do with Iowa's field crops isn't going to produce a very enjoyable culinary experience, I don't think.
All right. And with edamame, could you put enough in a planter to make it worth your while?
It would have to be a big container.
Okay.
A big container, yes.
If you wanted to get kind of the amount that you'd get in a frozen bag in the grocery store, yeah, that's going to take a few, nine, 10 square feet worth of plants, I would imagine.
All right.
So it might be more trouble than he thinks.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for being here today. Andy Larson is a specialist in small farm sustainability with Iowa State University Extension. Don't wait so long to come back next time, Andy.
Okay. Anytime, Charity.
All right, thanks a lot. And Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Thank you very much, Richard.
You're welcome.
And we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And with me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. It's a News Buzz Friday.
It is. Let me rattle off a few things we'll be talking about. A rash of home invasions in Des Moines. Very scary. This is when people burglarize your home while you're there. We'll talk about that. Also have Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz on to talk about voter fraud cases, new charges there. Two new studies, Charity, one showing Iowa is one of the most dangerous states to drive in, and another showing part of eastern Iowa, one of the least Bible-minded areas in the country. We'll find out what that's about.
All right. Thanks a lot. That's coming up at noon. This is Talk of Iowa.